Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
One of the intriguing cultural questions arising from the Irish War of Independence and Civil War period was the fate of the Abbey Theatre. It was established while Ireland was still under British rule, with W.B. Yeats and Lady Augusta Gregory at the helm, and would become one of Ireland's main arenas for art and ideas. Now, while the Abbey wasn't Dublin's first theatre, its arrival was linked to the growing Gaelic revival movement, which has already seen the establishment at that time of the GAA. It was the first of its kind to produce plays that were written by Irish playwrights and performed by Irish actors. And 100 years ago, it became the first state-subsidised theatre in the English-speaking world, earning funding from the newly independent Irish Free State. Well, Diarmaid Ferriter is here now, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, to bring us the story of the Abbey. Hello, Diarmaid. Good
morning,
to have
Claire.
You. Now, what was the background to that decision in 1925, the one I just mentioned, where it was going to have state-subsidised funding? Why?
There's a real challenge there with the creation of the new Free State in relation to cultural priorities and what will become of the Abbey. Yeats and Lady Gregory, who you mentioned there, who of course had been stalwarts at the helm of this cultural revival, and they took the business of the Abbey very seriously and legacy very seriously as well. And they are heading into the twilight of their careers at that stage. So they begin discussing this actually during the great period of upheaval, the end of the War of Independence, the start of the Civil War. They're discussing it in late 1921 because their intention had always been to hand over the Abbey Theatre to a new state. They didn't know at that stage what that state would be, and they couldn't have predicted perhaps that it would be civil war and that climate there. But they had been discussing this. And what they are thinking about is, if there's going to be an attempt to establish, say, a rival theatre, if someone like Arthur Griffith or Constance Markievicz, who may have had qualms about the kind of plays that the Abbey did, if they tried to establish a rival theatre, well, then perhaps the Abbey could stay alone and independent as a theatre that stood for intellectual freedom. But the problem for them is financial. Mm-hmm. The overdraft is £2,000 in 1923. They're facing insolvency. So they begin to think again about handing it over, but perhaps with a state subsidy so that they would retain some degree of control. And they use go-betweens like Lennox Robinson, who was also an Abbey playwright. They had certain contacts in the government, like Desmond Fitzgerald and Ernest Blythe, who were government ministers, the new pro-treaty government. And they put their soundings out. What they're looking for is an annual state theatre to keep the theatre solvent. But they don't want to give up artistic control. So there's to-ing and fro-ing. And initially the government is hesitant. They don't necessarily want to be seen in public to be associated with a character like Yeats. I mean, his stock is very high by 1923. He's been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's world-renowned poet at that stage. But he's also associated with controversy around delicate questions like divorce and partition. He's also in the Shannon as a very independent voice at this stage. So a lot of the work is done behind the scenes. Eventually they agree £1,000 a year as a state subvention. That's reduced to £850 as a result of the straitened financial times and the cost of the Civil War. And it's agreed to, and it is announced exactly 100 years ago in 1925.
So what about that question of artistic control? What conditions came with the 1,000 down to 850?
There were no conditions, in theory. Now, the government is going to have a representative that comes with this state subsidy. And for the announcement of the state subsidy, Yeats, as always, likes to frame particular moments with an eye on posterity. So he invited Blythe into the Abbey for dinner on stage after a performance. And Yeats makes a speech in which he refers to the intelligence, generosity and courage of the government. And he talks about the years of anxious labour that he and Gregory and John Milton Singh had endured in trying to build the Abbey. But that this is the beginning of a new phase, and they have an opportunity now to give voice to Irish ideas and Irish minds. Mm-hmm. And the question, of course, is how will this work in practice? There are no strings attached. There isn't an official theatre censor in the way that censorship applies to films and later books. So there is a degree of artistic license there. The question is, what will the government representative want? And the government representative, it turns out, is George O'Brien. And George O'Brien is a renowned economist. And he's there, of course, in theory, to financially advise the Abbey Theatre. But in practice, he sees himself as a moral gatekeeper. And that theme of moral gatekeeping in the 1920s is a very strong one. And it only takes a year for this question of artistic freedom versus the subsidy to burst into life and controversy as a result of a very talented playwright, Sean O'Casey, who at this time, 100 years ago, was in his tenement in Dublin's North Circular Road, typing away. He had a sign above his desk saying, "Get on with the bloody play." That bloody play was a bloody good play. It was The Plough and the Stars. He submitted it to the Abbey in the summer of 1925 and they planned to stage it in February 1926. And this began a huge controversy about artistic
freedom. The row erupted then over that play. And so the piece lasted for a year.
It's very interesting because, you know, Lady Gregory was so impressed by this playwright. They had a very interesting relationship, herself and Sean O'Casey, because they came from such different backgrounds. But she was hugely impressed with his use of language, with what she described as the futility and the irony and the tragedy of his plays. And she was really impressed with The Plough and the Stars. And Yeats travelled to Coole Park, to her estate, to talk to her about it, because there were problems with the language. The language was very edgy. And of course, O'Casey was brilliant at making Dublin language sing and cry and dance and provoke. So they knew they would have a difficulty on their hands.
She recorded
in her diary, "Our position is clear. If we have to choose between our freedom and the subsidy, we will choose our freedom."
Mm-hmm.
And she then travelled to Dublin with Yeats. They had a meeting of the board of the Abbey, and George O'Brien, the government representative, was at that. And she gave him a stern lecture on the history of the Abbey's battles with censorship over the years. And he objected in particular to the language of the play. What kind of language was he objecting to? The use of bitch, jesus, lousers, lice, the presence of a prostitute on stage, the tricolour coming into a pub. And even some of the Abbey actors were having qualms about this. One of them wrote to Yeats and Gregory and said that the language of this play, to use an Abbey phrase, is beyond the beyonds.
Mm.
And some of the actors' confessors wouldn't allow them to say these lines. So, you know, they're taking a serious risk there. But interestingly, this is classic Lady Gregory. She recorded this in her diary. George O'Brien wanted an objectionable song removed from Act Two of the play. And the way she recorded it in her diary was, "We had already decided to get rid of it, but I left it as a bone for him to gnaw at."
Ah, listen, classic negotiation. Let him feel like he has a win. And where did Yeats stand on all of this?
Yeats, fully behind.
He was with her
Lady
on
Gregory,
this.
And he was impressed too. And he also could sense that this might be an opportunity to establish the parameters in relation to the future of the Abbey and its relationship with the state. And of course, controversy can be good for business, Claire. When you think about, you know, this becomes a very public controversy because Republican women in particular object strongly to it, including Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and Maud Gonne, who had lost their husbands in the 1916 Rising, because, you know, O'Casey is attacking the heroic narrative of 1916 alongside other things. And it becomes a very public controversy. There are letters written. Hannah Sheehy Skeffington insists that this play is making a mockery and a byword of a revolutionary movement on which the current structures are supposed to rest, and that in no other country would a state-subsidised theatre be allowed to do this. So it becomes a very public controversy, but it goes ahead. It plays to packed audiences, and Yeats and Lady Gregory and O'Casey won that particular battle.
And did things settle down then after that?
They did, to a degree. There's a degree of self-censorship that is in operation because they recognise that there are times when they have to withdraw plays in order to prevent further controversy, in order to, you know, ensure their financial security.
So even though she had said, I'm happy not to have the subsidy and put this play on, she was very much aware they needed that money.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is the delicate balancing act that they're involved in. And there are times in the 1920s and the 1930s when what is going on offstage is much more compelling than any onstage drama. I mean, the feuds and the disputes in relation to the management and the direction of the Abbey. Frederick Higgins, for example, the Mayo poet, the neo-romantic poet who was managing the Abbey at one stage in the 1930s, a very authoritarian figure, very sexist. He hounds Teresa Devey, for example, a very successful woman playwright out of the Abbey. He hounds Frank O'Connor out because of his private life, because he had committed adultery. He's a complete hypocrite because he's actually
he himself is
having an affair with one of the Abbey actors. And, you know, actors like Ria Mooney and Aidan O'Connor really felt the full weight of his wrath. That's all going on behind the scenes. And then there's a row about what constitutes an Abbey play. And Ernest Blythe becomes very much a part of this story as well, because he leaves politics after 1932, having been the government minister who was fated in 1925. But he becomes a director of the Abbey and then a managing director from 1941 to 1967. So the endurance of his reign is extraordinary. And the Abbey becomes much more associated with his Irish language priorities, with pantomimes, with potboilers, what are referred to as kitchen comedies and parlour tragedies. And there were those who felt that it was losing its way artistically. And there wasn't enough edgy work, that was being done really in the Gate Theatre, for example. Like the Gate would have staged Dennis Johnson's The Lady Says No, rather than the Abbey, which had rejected it. And they also rejected Sean O'Casey's The Silver Tassie. So he comes back into the frame in 1928 and he's furious. This is his First World War play. European drama is changing, it's expressionist. And the Abbey say no.
So the Abbey then became to be seen, did it, as quite conservative as time went on. Would that be fair?
It did. No, there's no doubt about that. And a lot of theatre historians have highlighted that era of conservatism. But we also have to consider what audiences wanted. Audiences didn't necessarily want the kind of plays that Lady Gregory and Yeats might want to prioritise, and indeed Sean O'Casey. They're more attracted to the potboilers, for example, of George Shields. And they will fill the houses, they will fill the theatre by staging them. But it does come at a particular cost. And that's why there's always been this debate around the Abbey about what's the balance to be struck between being a national theatre and being innovative and being original and being controversial, but also trying to keep your financial solvency.
So you mentioned at the beginning that legacy was very important to Lady Augusta Gregory and Yeats. So when it came to the end, or when this thing came to be properly established, how did they feel they had achieved?
Oh, they felt they had achieved a lot. And Yeats was always looking back and talking about himself and Gregory and Synge and what they had built. You know, that idea of the hard labour and the endurance and the resilience. But that there was always going to be a power vacuum after Yeats was gone. Lady Gregory dies in 1932, Yeats in 1939. And it's really into that vacuum that Ernest Blythe steps. And there are conservative decades. It would be invidious to single Blythe out, as I've mentioned. There were other factors at play there. But there is that degree of self-censorship. There's also sometimes the prudishness of the actors themselves. They are products of their time too. I mean, there were radical voices in there and brilliant talent. But they sometimes too had qualms about getting involved in edgy drama. And there is something of a renaissance, you could say, from the late 1960s, particularly with Tomás Magana becoming an artistic director, for example. But even in the 1970s, like 50 years after the initial grant, the Abbey is playing to 65% occupancy. There are 36 Abbey players and artistic directors, brilliant people like Lelia Dooling and later Joe Dowling. They're still talking about the contradictions and limitations that are imposed on them. And the way Tomás Magana had put that in the early 1970s, you know, running the Abbey, it's not just a theatrical enterprise, it's a national enterprise. And there were always critics who were prepared to accuse them of relying on past glories. Of present glories, there were not enough. That's the way Tyrone Guthrie, another theatre director, put it. And of course, a play like The Play on the Stars became a touchstone play for the Abbey. It still is. And some argued that they relied on them too much. And of course, because it's getting significant funding, the actual initial grant is increased in 1926 and 1927 to £1,000. It remains at that level until 1947. So there isn't huge room for manoeuvre in relation to the finances. But even when things get a bit more flush, there's always controversy over the Abbey getting a much bigger portion of state funding of the arts.
So that lift from 850 to 1,000, that coincided with the opening of the Peacock, did it, in 1927?
At the Gate. And the Peacock, I mean, they're, Dublin is thriving in many ways when it comes to its theatre output. But the Abbey did not have the same freedom, you could argue, to take the kind of risks that, say, the Gate was taking, even though, of course, the Gate is operating within a much tighter financial constraint. So there's plenty of theatrical endeavour. And amateur dramatics is really thriving in Ireland as well in the 1940s and the 1950s. But the Abbey really remained the focus. In some respects, it was damned if it did and damned if it didn't. The way one critic put that at a later stage, if the Abbey had a poor set for a play, it was berated for that. But if it had a really impressive one, it was criticised for extravagance.
For spending.
You know, there was an element of that associated with it. But you can see younger playwrights and the work of younger playwrights being championed from the 1960s onwards.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in a way, is its second coming. Because if you think of those early days, even the pre-independence days where they are, you know, they're looking at young Irish playwrights, including
and also,
of course,
the very prestigious school of acting in
the Abbey,
came early days as well, didn't it?
And very talented actors. And they had their own stories to tell, because many of them were immersed, of course, in the story of the Revolution. And it's paralleled by Yeats's own poetic and theatrical endeavours, because he was very conscious of how that period would be framed. And he, in a way, is talking about an identity that's forged in revolution. And that can be a very positive thing and a very empowering thing. But it can also turn into quite a conservative force in relation to trying to protect the legacy as they would see it, and not necessarily moving with the times in the way that they need to be a vibrant and fresh theatre.
And as mentioned there at the beginning, it was the first state-subsidised model of theatre. I mean, was that followed then in other countries? Of course, we were in between two wars at the time, so maybe not initially.
Well, there was always a reluctance on the part of theatres to be dependent
to go down
on
that
state
road.
Funding.
Yeah.
And you can see why. And they would have seen the dangers, I suppose, of losing that balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can see it. I mean, there's a lot of controversy in the 1960s, for example, about the pay rates for the Abbey actors, and does the government need to intervene and take outside arbitration? Todd Andrews at one stage gets involved in that and suggests that really the Abbey should move fully into state ownership. And become a more stable entity. But again, that would raise the question, of course, of artistic control. And even in relation to wider arts acts and arts legislation, should there be an arm's length approach to the state and the arts?
Mm-hmm.
That has always been a theme. That remains a very controversial theme to this day.
Certainly does, Dermot. Thank you very much. Dermot Ferriter there from UCD. We have